And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund here in the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and we're here with your co-host and raconteur, Mr. Nuffity Nuff, Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Haglund, thank you. The Oscar madness is behind us.
Yes.
The season of self-congratulation that lasts many seasons.
Many
now.
Seasons. It's more than one.
It never goes out of fashion, does
never
it?
Does. No. I've congratulated more people. Congratulations, Phil Lairness.
Well, no, Dean.
For winning the Oscar
Just to be nominated as one of your co-hosts.
And there's been many nominations.
It's such an honor.
But I'd like to point out, you did win the betting pool this year, and I do have to sit through a Twin Peaks.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, actually,
you
because
did.
There have been some questions about this,
really?
Including from our good friend
yep.
and guest and colleague and collaborator, a man who's helped us in many ways, Yoshi Kato,
Yoshi.
Who wants to know. You remember a couple weeks ago when he asked a question that was at the outset, we answered at the outset about stop motion
yeah.
animation?
Yeah.
And he sent me kind of a mea culpa going, whoops, I guess I should preface in the future questions that I don't actually intend for being on the show. Because he did not mean to grind it to a halt. Anyway, he
wow.
wanted to know whether we would record in some way the viewing experience a la Mystery Science Theater 2000. And I don't know if I want to do that. I don't think that's the spirit of it so much. But
it is funny.
But I think we could, even though obviously the pilot on DVD is without commercial breaks, you do know when the
breaks happen.
Were,
yeah,
the act breaks. It would be kind of fun to at least stop and just
record
and I'll interview you about what we've seen thus far.
Well, you know, actually, having been there now, you forced me there five times. How many? Three? Went twice.
What are you talking about?
The town of Twin Peaks. How many times have we been there?
Five times.
It feels like five times. I always think of the town that the replicated Twin Peaks in real life. That we constantly drive through every time we're in the Pacific Northwest.
Constantly drive through it.
That we have to stop and take pictures. That town, I would think now that I'm so familiar with it, I would think that maybe viewing Twin Peaks might be easier.
It might be easier.
Might be. I'm just saying.
And so then when you do watch the Twin Peaks pilot, will that make visiting the town easier or more challenging the next time?
Well, I don't know. I'm hoping it makes everything easier, but it's probably more challenging.
Because I'm imagining we could find you an underground comedy club with 12 people to perform there.
Right, just like I did in Colorado Springs last weekend. What a good time that was.
How was Colorado Springs? Do you know?
Very, you know, it's their very first convention, Galaxy Fest. And I guess people at their very first convention didn't really know things that you do at conventions. Like, for instance, that the people who come there with their 8x10 are there to sell them. A lot of people didn't realize that. And so they basically just tried to take stuff off your table and then are shocked when you say, well, yes, that's... I'll take cash for that.
I've actually been beginning to wonder
yes.
when it would happen that someone would just pick up a copy of The Truth Is Out There, like after a screening or something, and then just look at it, look at the back of it for a while. I don't mean make like an end run.
Yeah.
You know, I just mean literally just pick it up and
pick
go,
it
okay,
up.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I'll take this.
Thank
you very much.
So
fortunately for me, when you and I are not at these events together, I often have the help of someone like Yoshi, who helped at UFO X-Fest. He was great.
Yep.
Or of course, Lily Holloman, who helps us a great deal of these. And she is fierce.
Right.
She is both fierce in her devotion to the film.
Uh-huh.
Because she really does love the movie. But also, I mean, I almost hope someone tries to get away with one.
Just to see that gang and whip ass open up.
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
That's with compassion.
With compassion, of course.
Yeah, with enlightened compassion.
Right. But whoop ass nonetheless.
Exactly.
Right. Ken with an sent
She's very big in the shamanic realms, and they don't want to cross her.
Well, I can understand why. Don't cross your shamanic realms. What did we learn from Ghostbusters?
I think we're mixing lines.
All right.
You did see that the message has finally gotten through, right, to Dan Aykroyd, at least, and everyone else, after Bill Murray kind of just went everywhere he possibly could to announce as loudly as he possibly could that the idea of doing a Ghostbusters 3 was so incredibly distasteful that he was not going to do it.
Right.
You know, and now I'm just waiting for, but isn't it just a negotiating ploy? But anyway, so apparently he's not going to do it.
He's not. He's out.
So let's put an end to that rumor.
Very good. That's where we were shooting down that rumor. It's like a rumor death.
Of course, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the second installment of our Chilpack Hollywood Movie Lovers Companion is now up both on our website, chilpackhollywood.com, and at our blog over on MySpace, myspace.com/chilpackhollywood, where we just talk about some of the loose ends of the Oscars. And one of the pieces that I particularly enjoy is, 17 nominations for Meryl Streep, gets her third win.
Yeah.
Looking back at what some of those were, because it was really sort of surprising how many I didn't know. Rattle off some off the top of your head, but there's some fairly obscure ones. And also, as much as you think, 17 films, she gets nominated every time out of the box, there were some great performances she gave that were not honored.
Sophie's Choice, I think, would be one.
Well,
did she win for that?
She actually won for that. That was her last one. She went 29 years between wins, the second longest wait between wins of anyone, the longest being?
Katharine Hepburn.
Very good. 34 years before she finally won again with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner,
Guess
1967. And then she won the very next year for Lion in Winter.
Lion in the Winter, that's
tie.
Right.
Which was a tie.
I did not know that.
Wasn't that with Barbara Streisand? The first tie ever.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, of course, Katharine Hepburn won again for On Golden Pond.
On Golden Pond.
So she ended with four, and that's who Meryl is chasing. Anyway, all this is in the Movie Lover's Companion, again, on our site and in the blog.
Right.
We got a question.
Oh, we like questions.
About the Oscars.
You can ask any question. We'll put it on the air. Just have to write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Absolutely.
So easy.
And we got an email following the Oscars.
Yes.
From Agent Summer.
Agent Summer. Oh, cool.
Who wrote Phil and Dean. I'm curious to get your take on the Bechdel test, which rates the frequency of women's meaningful presence in the movies. According to the video, and there was a link to it, which I watched, many of this year's Academy Award winners show a disturbing trend, either excluding women discussing something other than men, or fail completely at having two women interact.
Oh.
Do you feel this, along with the other issues you've discussed on your show, has contributed to the decline in attendance/ticket sales for movies? And that's, again, from Agent Summer. And I did think that this is kind of a question that stokes my passion.
Right. Of course it does. But, of course, two films coming right to mind that negate that are The Help and Bridesmaids.
Okay. However, with Bridesmaids,
your bugaboo is there's a guy at the end of it who's...
Well, but the question, they show a disturbing trend either excluding women discussing something other than men.
Uh-huh. Well, and they did. They discussed their relationship.
Eventually, they do, though it is fair to say that much of that was always pushed off against by conversations about men.
Yeah, that's true.
And then that would lead in discussion of, you don't need men, you know. And,
but to my mind, that was just because they were taking the most stand-up comedy bits and putting them into one screenplay.
And to a degree, you've got to start somewhere.
Right. But yes, point taken. That is true. There is a discussion.
But I would agree with you, though. I mean, I would say, look, and Bridesmaids wouldn't be the problem. If we had many other films,
that's right.
Then
fact that I can just pull out two because of their exceptions proves the point.
Yeah. So there was two. There were nine films nominated for Best Picture, and it's only been a week, and who knows if we could even name the others off the top of our head.
I know.
But if you think of the other nominees, let's talk about The Descendants.
Yeah.
the only scene, I think, where women actually interact with each other is when the daughter expresses how angry she is with her comatose mother.
Yeah.
In The Descendants.
And that's right. Yeah, this is a one-way conversation.
And I do want to point out that many of these films do have well... Some of these films
yes.
have well-drawn female characters.
Mm-hmm.
However, first of all, they're in support to men. And secondly, again...
Written.
They don't get to interact, again, with other women. So you've got Best Picture nominees, The Descendants.
Yeah.
Artist, which, of course, is a little unfair because nobody says anything.
But there is discussions going on.
It would still fail according to the Bechdel test.
Yes.
You've got Hugo.
Hugo.
And really, the two female characters are very supporting, the little girl and then her grandmother.
And grandmother.
And then you've got the shopkeeper.
You're right.
War Horse with another supporting character of the mother played by, is it Emily Watson? Is that right?
Who it was, that I could think? Be, yep.
There's four. We've named six
Tree of
the
Life.
Nine. Tree of Life, a supporting character. The most important character, really, Jessica Chastain. But again, it's about her relationship all to men. Her sons, her husband.
Moneyball.
Of course.
And no women. the daughter.
Again, the ex-wife and the daughter.
Yeah.
But again, it's all male-driven. It's really good point that the two are clearly the exception.
Yeah. And so here's the other thing, though. A lot of the screenwriters are men in this sort of field, too. So... To have a man write a conversation between two women.
Well, we're talking about Oscars right now.
Right.
We're talking about Oscar-nominated films. We'll open it up a little bit wider, but since we are talking about the Academy.
Yes.
Which has also been getting accused, by the way, of not being fanboy-friendly.
What?
Yeah, there's been a lot of articles I've read about why do they reject fanboy-friendly films.
So Transformers should have been nominated.
But the answer to both of these
yes.
might be, or Harry Potter. Dark Knight.
That was why the 10 came in the first place, because
right.
Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight Batman was so a very good film in and of itself, and yet... As you said, it was considered just a fanboy summer tentpole that it missed anybody taking it seriously.
So I just thought, who is the Academy then?
The Chilpack Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
If we're going to have this conversation about the Academy first, then who is the Academy?
Demographic breakdown?
I got the demographic breakdown. Of course, the identities of members is kept very
secret.
Guarded,
yes.
Secret.
You have to be
Although
invited.
I found out that Vin Diesel is a member. and by the way, you know, there's this thought that it's all the previous nominees and the previous winners. And yes, that's the easiest way.
To get into the Academy.
Automatically.
Yeah.
But it's not the most likely way to
right.
get in.
Eric Estrada is a member.
I think there's only 13% of the Academy are former nominees and something only like 2% are former winners. Because there are very few winners.
Right.
But there's 7,500 or something like that members of the Academy. Anyway, these are some interesting things.
Okay.
94% white.
Oh, wow.
That's a little out of proportion to society
regular,
at large.
Right.
Yeah. 77% male. Here we go. 77% in a culture, in a country, in a world where women outnumber men by quite a degree.
Yeah, 51-49%
In this country, at least. I think it's 52-48, but it's broader around the world.
Wow.
54% of the Academy are over 60 years old.
Ouch. That would explain the fanboy issue.
2% are under 40. 2%.
Wow. Well, because you have to...
You've had to obtain a certain body of work to be able to...
Right, and be invited in by, two others.
So it isn't about ageism so much as it's just that's...
It takes that long to get recognized and be into that
circle. So why do I bring this up? I bring this up again when we're talking about the Academy-nominated films and what they reflect.
Right.
It's always through the prism of how people see the world, and you can start to draw a certain... Profile. As much as we're not allowed to do that.
In reverse.
In this. But I would like to point out that there were really good films. It's not that were made that
did not get
that shine a different light on this issue.
Okay.
I guess my point is it's not that the movies that we're talking about, movies that would give not only women lead roles, but give them relationships and stories and chances to interact about something other than men.
Right.
With each other and something other than about men.
yes.
These movies are being made. They aren't being marketed, perhaps.
Right. The classic.
And they're not being marketed for award consideration, perhaps.
Right, because that's an expensive campaign.
But how about just looking at some of the really good films we've discussed on this show? Margaret.
Wow, there's a good example.
Now, here's a film. Now, again, maybe it's sad that I'm reaching back to 2005 for a film, but it was a release last year. I love Jay Hoberman's post-Oscar article with the headline, "The Wrong Margaret Won Best Actress."
Oh, look at that.
And it's hard not to make that argument to a degree.
Interesting.
But so this is a film very much about, a mother-daughter relationship,
yeah,
and about how they interact. You do see them interacting with men and women in their lives, but it's not about male-female relationships in that,
per
in that
se.
Way. Melancholia. This is, at its core, a story between two sisters.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I haven't seen that one.
You have, of course, I love that it is both a dogma film and a sci-fi film.
Yeah.
And the concept of having a film about two sisters really maybe is either way artsy or it's just a science fiction concept.
Yeah, two, you cannot maybe actually.
Two women being able to carry a story on their own.
That's science
what
fiction.
What is this, a science fiction world? there's We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Ah, right. That one with the.
With Tilda Swinton.
With Tilda Swinton.
There's
though they're talking about Kevin, so that's a male relationship.
Well, the title is "We Need to Talk About Kevin." That's the one thing that's never done.
All right,
that's the whole point. We culturally need to talk about Kevin because it's too easy within a family not to.
Right,
and this is how these things come about.
Fantastic.
There are some Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Oh yeah, that one you really liked.
This is another one. I loved Seth Rogen's comment at the Spirit Awards, formerly the Independent Spirit Awards.
Right, right.
Where he was talking about the year that was in cinema, and he said, "There's another Olsen girl, Elizabeth Olsen, and she's the best one. Where the hell have they been hiding her?" And she's going to be playing the female lead in Spike Lee's Old Boy, which a film we've talked about. But anyway, yes. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene here is a female-driven film. At its heart, again, a story between two sisters.
Right.
And
who better to know than an Olsen sister?
So again, we're talking about some indie films.
Right.
Another indie film, The Future, which I've talked about here. And now here's one where they're not lead characters. Coriolanus.
Oh, yes. Readaptation of the Shakespeare play.
Obviously, the title character played by Ralph Fiennes is the lead character.
But the mother.
The mother and his wife, Coriolanus' wife, played again by Jessica Chastain.
Right.
Basically, the rule of thumb is Jessica Chastain is in the kind of movies we're looking for. But those are, and those scenes with each other between Jessica Chastain and Vanessa Redgrave are everything that, again, the Bechdel test is looking for.
Right.
And are remarkable. And here's a film that failed to get
nomination.
Despite the fact that Vanessa Redgrave's performance is the whole reason you have awards in the first place.
Right.
But she, again, in terms of marketing, she didn't go and do the Q&A circuit.
And you actually have to get that film in front going, look at this. Similar to the way Andy Serkis tried to get his performance in Rise of the Planet of the Apes by paying for that front page on the Variety, which was in lenticular three dimension, both his face and the character he played. So, how much did that cost? That's not an expensive thing to do. And there was some people in Andy's camp that was really going after it and still failed to get it. But, case in point, you have to pay money. You got to pay to play, basically, in the Oscars.
Yeah, and I think that's why, everybody was so surprised that this was Gary Oldman's first Oscar nomination. I wouldn't be surprised if this was the first time Gary Oldman made the rounds.
Right. That would make a lot of sense.
Because he does strike me as the sort of actor that may not have had a lot of patience for that when he was younger.
Yeah, totally.
There are also, there's foreign language films.
Yes.
That, you know, that would pass with flying colors, the Bechdel test. How about A Separation, which won Best Foreign Language Film? Another film from France that I included, you know, in that blog about overlooked films. The Hedgehog.
Right, which I haven't seen.
There's documentaries that passed this test. The Interrupters, Steve James.
The one you love so much.
And Pina in 3D.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there are these films out there in a variety of different genres, foreign, American, independent, documentary.
You just have to find them.
Yes.
And that's a lot of work.
Another documentary, The Arbor, the one that I told you about that Josh Glasgow called to my attention.
Oh, yeah.
About, you know, the very innovative approach of having actors lip sync to the recorded interviews.
Yeah.
This is all about a mother and her daughter, really, the story of this mother who was a playwright and her surviving daughters and what got visited upon them.
Right.
And so... anyway, these are being made.
Right.
That's the
point is they are out there. You just aren't seeing them because of the way.
And the question, again, that Agent Summer posed was about, does this contribute to the lack of ticket sales and business, the fact that these are at the very least not being marketed? And I – look, going back to what we said, women outnumber men. And what we're seeing – from box office, and we're seeing from
studio the
percentages.
Release.
No, but what we're seeing from the percentage of audiences, and we're seeing from women are more interested in seeing movies than men are across the board, especially young women.
Right.
So it does just from a business sense, standpoint, it stands to reason that more films need to be made that are not for women because I hate.
That term,
phrase.
Yes.
I hate the idea that we're making it for some specific group. Because hopefully you're telling a story that...
appeals universally.
Yeah, has a universal appeal. That doesn't mean it will appeal universally.
Right.
But has a universal appeal that anyone can get into it. It's for the humanity within all of us.
Right.
But certainly I think it's safe to say that it makes good business sense to make films, therefore, about women.
Right.
And marketed to women. You can make it for everyone, but as we've talked about, you do need to market it effectively at least to a sizable enough audience that it can be viable.
Right. And that's the thing. Stop chasing the 14-year-old boy demographic because those kids are all sitting in front of their PlayStations and their Xboxes and, you know, and that what's made Call of Duty number... the third largest franchise without having a movie or any plush or anything like that. Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, with Harry Potter, there's theme parks, there's all of that sort of thing, and toys and stuff like that. Call of Duty, all they have is the game. That's it. And that is now ranked number three as the most profitable franchise.
And you think about Twilight, which is almost exclusively an audience made up of women, of girls, young women. And, you know, every studio turned this down.
Right.
And, you know, Lily's brother said to me at one point, how could every studio turn that down? I mean, you know, and I said, well, the prevailing interest was that belief was that young girls don't make decisions in terms of
how
money gets spent in a household. And he has, Vernon has two sons and one daughter, and he says, in my household, the girl makes the decisions of how the money gets spent. And I would think that that's pretty much true.
I think it's true across the board.
You know, you think of the American Girl series. Isn't it American Girl? The books and the dolls and everything. So, no, there is purchasing power in being a young woman. There's purchasing power in being a mature woman. So from a business standpoint, absolutely, it is ridiculous.
Absolutely. And that ridiculousness is historic. You think of all the marketing over the years and movies, how there's been a 10-year lag between what society's going on, and it takes one movie to come through. Easy Rider is a perfect example of that, where they suddenly caught on to something where just before that it was Tab Hunter movies. You know, there's a sociological shift that happens that it takes marketing good 5 to 10 years to catch up to.
And from a cultural perspective, right, living in as a culture that, that claims to aspire to equality.
Claiming.
Both in terms of opportunity and respect.
Right.
And in equal appreciation, right, for all of our differences.
You would think.
And as a society that constantly demonstrates the perils of failing to achieve those goals, you know, in myriad ways, from violence to persecution, poverty, depression, you know, it is incumbent upon those of us, I feel, who tell stories to raise as many mirrors as
possible,
you know, as many diverse
exactly.
mirrors as possible.
You want to show that diversity.
That, you know, and especially specifically in terms of this question, as many mirrors as possible to reveal and reflect, you know, and explore the ever different, ever changing flowering of womanhood in her endlessly varied form.
Right.
Because we all have mothers. I mean, it doesn't matter to me that the Academy is 77% men, or that maybe the majority of people making films are men, because we all have mothers, we all have sisters,
yes.
we all have daughters,
yeah.
we all have friends.
Right. Fried Green Tomatoes was written by a man. I mean, that does not necessitate that you
exactly.
don't have a sympathy or empathy for that.
And
know,
don't
those
we all want to have a world where these women that we care about feel honored.
Right. And are included in the stories.
And as we are in this particular business, how we can honor them is by telling and sharing those stories.
Absolutely.
That honor them.
Yeah.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
We've got 2 weeks to cover on on Monday the 20th, I saw All About Walking, Dragonfly. I've lost count of how many times I've seen it.
Always funny. What movie did they do this time?
Choose Your Own Walking Adventure? They actually combined a couple that was pretty good. They did a sequel to Transformers, Brokeback Transformers. That was really funny.
That's hilarious.
It was great. on Tuesday, the 21st,
right?
So last Tuesday. I attended a. Wait a minute! No, that would be Tuesday the 20th. What was last Tuesday?
The
28th.
28th. Yeah. Right.
Tuesday the 28th. Because this is Monday, March 5th.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
This show was pre-recorded.
So Tuesday the 28th, I attended a staged reading at the Geffen Playhouse.
Oh, my God. Big deal.
Of Coney Island Christmas. This is a world premiere that's going to be their holiday show this year.
Written
by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Margulies.
Wow.
And so that it was kind of cool getting to see it after a couple days of workshopping it.
Yeah,
and
big stars.
There were some stars.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
And was it funny? Was it witty, like a Neil Simon Rockaway Beach or whatever?
It's a work in progress. I don't think it's fair to...
Didn't say it's gag fest.
Well, I don't think it's fair to criticize it one way or another. It's a work in progress.
Right.
So, and I think to be allowed...
Is it going towards that is what I'm saying.
I think it... There is no doubt to me that the thing's going to be a big hit.
Okay. Awesome.
Ask me when it is a big hit if I think it's any good. Because those are separate discussions.
Fantastic.
Right?
It's going to be a big
and
hit.
I will see it when it's there because okay. I will know people who
awesome.
Will be in it.
And of course.
And then, of course, last Thursday, the 1st of March,
yes.
I saw at the Autry, something I've been talking about, the opening night of their series of Native Voices, I saw a performance of Walking on Turtle Island.
Wow. This is the Autry, the Gene Autry Museum down
yes.
by the LA Zoo that
yeah,
I always
exactly.
drive by, and I never think to go in there. I always assume it's just Gene Autry's stuff in a big
No,
warehouse.
They have a wonderful theater. They do a lot of performances, and they're doing an ongoing series of theatrical pieces called Native Voices. It's part of a series, and there's two shows playing throughout the spring there under the auspices of Native Voices, and one of them is Walking on Turtle Island. Maybe next week I'll tell a little more about it, although we'll... Well, at some point, I'd like to get, as a guest, Gene Bruce Scott, who's the executive director of this, and who, when I was a young person, I loved because she was the star of the TV series Airwolf.
Oh, no way. Airwolf's gone down. That was filmed up in Vancouver, I believe it or
well,
not.
Well, you'll have a lot
we'll
to
have
talk
so much to talk about.
About.
My good friend Gary Jones was in Airwolf.
We had also a resolution to begin each show with what we're reading.
Ah, yes. Fantastic. Well, I just got a new novel. Of course, at the convention was a sitting beside me at the table was British author Sam Stone. Sam Stone has written a lot of vampire novels, and some of them historically researched. And as we got to talking, she actually researched as one of the major undead vampire kings, my great 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 grandfather from 1515, the king of the Vasa line, King Harald, the father to King Eric the 14th. For those of you who know, the Hagland line is the illegitimate offspring of Eric the 14th, and Eric's dad is predominantly featured in this novel. That is right here. Yeah, so I'm all excited.
Yeah, feel free to just keep talking as you walk away from the microphone.
It's called Demon Dance by Sam Stone right there. Look at that.
Wow.
How about that?
Look at that art.
So I just started that one.
That bears a resemblance.
I know, right? Even though I think she's supposed to be female, but that was the way my hair looked back then.
Exactly, back then. Yeah. I have been reading Alec Guinness's second and final installment of his diary, published diary.
Oh, yeah.
From 96 to 98.
Wow.
And it's...
Post-Star Wars.
Oh, yeah, boy. Don't get him started on Star Wars.
No, he was not. Towards the end, it sort of got to him.
A positively final appearance.
All right.
Yeah. He really did. And it's very interesting. I mean, he was really very concerned about...
humanity.
About the whole... what the blockbuster mentality would do... culturally, to
right,
us. And it,
sure enough, he was right.
You know, so anyway, but it's wonderful. It's not these are diary of his daily life in those 2 years towards the end of his life.
So,
and of course, some of it is spent with reminiscences, and some of it is spent with old friends. But most of it is about
going to the store on
what he's seeing.
Need some batteries
with his and
not like that. No, it's not like a journal of him.
It is.
I'm running errands.
A journal, yeah. Sometimes
really?
It is, but really? It's just he's so interesting and witty all I can say is that there's just this wonderful spell. It was actually given to me by Patrick McGoohan.
Oh. And you're just reading it now?
And I'm just reading it now, yeah.
Wow.
Because, you know, I had a little falling out with Pat and then his death and everything, and it was just a little too soon to read it. And now I'm reading it, and it makes me... It actually, I was realizing this as I'm approaching the end of the book, it makes me sad that Alec Guinness is dead. And yeah. He's been dead for a while, but it makes me sad.
Suddenly you realize.
And it makes me even more sad that someday I'll be dead. I'm serious. This is what... I don't know. It's very strange.
Do you know nobody gets out of here alive? Every living thing on this planet dies.
I think... But I don't know if that's true, because the living on this planet outnumber the dead by a great number. More people are alive now than have ever died throughout human history.
Okay.
So how do we know that? More than 50% of the total human population has not ever died.
So you're saying that if that rate continues, that eventually...
I'm just talking math. I'm just saying
straight from
math.
If I follow this graph, I'm just saying that the graph you just posted with the 2 points
I'm just
of
saying...
that, you're sad that you're going to die.
Yeah, I'm going to die.
Yes.
And I'm more sad about that than Alec Guinness being dead.
Well,
I'm not proud of it. It came up. Speaking of, and perhaps the best segue we've ever had on the show.
For jazz,
celebrity deaths.
Let's go.
Celebrity deaths.
First off, the Monkees.
That news broke while I was on the midweek drive.
Really?
Last week. And it was great because, TMZ broke it long before it hit the news.
Right.
And so I got to, point out that, although on the midweek drive there in the UK, of course, I referred to it as TMZ.
Right. Very good. Yeah. I'm glad you're culturally aware. Fantastic.
Keeping TMZ. Up my end of the
Absolutely.
Special relationship. So you're right. Davy Jones, Monkees.
Yes.
I guess we'll start with that.
And I think he
Spoiler
was just
alert.
At the Hollywood signing show that I was at.
Was he really?
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I was trying to look back, but there was one of the, and he had the guitar and he was strumming away for the fans and singing and signing. He was right there beside Martin Landau. And I was just around the corner from
only 66 years old.
I know.
Of course, charming. I mean, he will always be Davy Jones from the Monkees.
Right.
He was a jockey.
Is that really?
Turned TV actor. No, turned TV actor in the UK.
Ah, right.
And then
auditioned
for stage. and did several big productions in the UK, in the West End, including playing the Artful Dodger in Oliver, which brought him to Broadway and then to the attention of Hollywood producers.
Wow.
So,
boy,
he had some chops and some credits before the Monkees. And I always like to just, you know,
point that out.
It's so easy to think of
the Monkees as just...
or to think of actors as this, you know, it was like somehow it was all just
goofy,
meaningless until the one role.
Right.
And no doubt he did really interesting work leading up to it.
Yeah.
And then this might just overshadow it, and certainly overshadowed everything that came thereafter.
After, for sure.
So I'm going to dust off the Bob Rafelson, Jack Nicholson penned feature film Head of the Monkees.
Oh, fantastic. And give that a watch.
Davy Jones.
Man, that's a trip.
We have, however, other celebrity deaths.
Very good.
Jan Berenstain of the Berenstain Bears.
Oh, yes.
At 88, died of a stroke.
I had no idea the Bears were that old. I don't know when they were created. I just remember always seeing them as the ubiquitous Bears that I always grew up with.
Because we have an international audience, Erland Josephson,
of course,
died at 88. Of course. You should know, he was, speaking of your heritage, he was the director of Sweden's Royal Dramatic Theater from 1966 to 1975.
I did know that, actually.
And more famously, perhaps, internationally,
he
acted in many of the films of Ingmar Bergman.
Yes.
Including as the star of the 1973 acclaimed masterpiece, Scenes from a Marriage.
That's right. That was him.
So?
See? And that Ingmar Bergman also came from that same theater group, which I actually visited in Stockholm. Historic theater that has turned out many a big star.
Other deaths. How about 20% of all movie theaters? I'm putting this under celebrity deaths.
Really?
We are about to lose 1,000 small theaters that can't afford the conversion to digital. And many of these are single screen theaters. Many of these are
smaller
Main
towns.
Street theaters.
Yeah.
And the question is, does it matter?
Oh.
Michael Hurley, the owner of the Colonial in Belfast, Maine, this gorgeous Main Street old movie theater, has a website called bigscreenbiz.com, and he just wrote an editorial in IndieWire. And so anyone who's interested in single screen theaters, and especially these really delightful theaters, and maybe what can be done to help them, check out bigscreenbiz.com or IndieWire. Again, Michael Hurley.
Well, you know what Vancouver did for a while there? They took a lot of these smaller single-screen theaters and then showed movies for $2.99 that were second, third run or stuff that you never saw. It was just up to some of the programmers that were film nerds in college, and then they came out and scraped some money together and showed very interesting, and they had some prints that were, you know, faded, of course, like that, in 35mm and some 16mm. But you showed them and you had some popcorn, and it was about marketing. It was like getting the information out there. But there were some films that I saw. I saw all of my Marx Brothers films on the big screen, which is a completely different experience than watching it on your TV, having that communal laughter.
Right? There is talk right now that cinemas should be raising prices for Oscar winners. Charge more to see these award-winning films in a way that they're meant to be seen. And... am I wrong in thinking that they should go in the exact opposite direction? Lower the prices? Make the Oscar winners less expensive?
Right.
Get people into the theater to take a chance on these films that are – and especially because, look, you don't go to see movies much anymore.
Right.
Right.
Even I don't.
A lot of people don't. And what we know is it is habit forming going to the movies.
Both directions.
And so – get people, entice them to come in and see quality work, and guess what? They're going to want to see more. And, oh, by the way, they're seeing those trailers, those coming attractions. They're seeing the posters in the lobby for films that are upcoming.
Totally.
Get
advertising.
Them in there, and what better way to get them in there than by saying, you know what? We're going to let you see a great film for less money.
Right. That would make sense, wouldn't it?
Lead with your best.
Lead with your best.
Television has understood this, actually, for a long time, which is why do you lose money as a network on producing and showing a hit show? You lose money on it because it's a loss leader.
Once it goes into syndication is where you make
it. Well, the production company does it, but the network never gets that money.
Right.
The network, which is losing money on it, gets it because it's setting up an entire night of viewing.
Right.
Other shows around it are helped. Yep. And, oh, by the way, the commercials for other shows that you show during that hit TV series
show. Yes.
Is helping those shows as well.
True enough.
So
yeah, it seems counterintuitive to raise prices.
It is just riding the direction in the horse that it's going. How can we milk more money out of this?
Yeah.
Instead of how can we maybe start to establish a better, healthier, long-term strategy?
Well, there is
instead
your...
Instead of just trying to keep the doors open.
I'm saying that thinking of long-term strategy no longer affects any studio and or corporate situation because you get fired instantly.
And maybe it doesn't even apply to the...
1,000 theaters going under.
Or to the SAG-AFTRA merger debate. We have less than 20 minutes left, and we really need to do this. This week, all the ballots went out.
Yes.
The information went out. Voting is going to take place. There is another effort to merge the two actors' unions, Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA. AFTRA, of course, also represents radio artists,
singing,
broadcasters,
news announcers,
many other things. And it is very interesting to be at this point where somehow, maybe because of external forces that are manipulating the actors.
What?
In some part, I'm sure that this is true.
Right.
Because I think we can agree that most actors, the vast majority, understand that one union is the way to go. There might be some people who are always going to be opposed to change. There might be some people who want it to just be SAG as a union, don't want a new merge union. There may be these things. But the point is that almost everybody would want one union, understands that you can't have two unions.
Yeah. In the history of labor,
against each other.
Negotiating you to the lowest dollar. Yeah.
What has been really disturbing to me, and we've been talking about this since we first started this show in 2007, there's been so much fear and vitriol and manipulation, turning actor against actor. And so I reached out to two people we personally know who are both of goodwill and good conscience.
Mm-hmm.
They are both, if I may say, generous and gentle, kind friends of ours.
Uh-huh.
Who, if they ever met under any other circumstances, and perhaps they have met, if they ever met under any other circumstances, would get on like gangbusters, I have no doubt, because they are both just absolute princes. And I'm talking about David Soboloff and Ari Gross, who we've both had on the show.
Yes.
And I reached out to both of them because I know that Ari has been very actively involved in trying to create the proposed new constitution for merger.
Yeah.
And I got the sneaking suspicion that David, who has been very active in guild politics.
Yes, absolutely. And the animation arms and the whole thing.
For years. That he might be opposed to the present condition of merger. So I wanted to reach out to both of them.
And see both sides of the point of view.
To get both sides. I will not advocate one way or another whether anyone ought to vote yes or no on this.
Okay.
And I don't do this as a cop-out. We got to move beyond this idea of endorsement anyway.
Right.
Like what movie stars are endorsing it? You can't trust them. They're movie stars. You need to be listening to TV actors. You know what? Just everybody needs to make their own informed decision.
Right.
You know?
And it's just getting that information. And what's the right information?
For you.
Yes.
What vote are you comfortable with?
Yeah.
You know, making or uncomfortable with but willing to risk?
Exactly.
Right? And no matter what happens, the only way that either through merger or failure of merger things are going to improve for actors in terms of negotiating or whatever, is if everyone starts to listen to each other now.
Right.
Because if this doesn't pass, where the hell do people go from there? And if it does pass, obviously there are lots of questions. And maybe we should get to this. David was quick to point out to me that the idea of merger is a great concept in theory, but virtually impossible to go ahead with as planned this time.
Because
of the absorption, of all of AFTRA.
Right.
Rather than just a...
The actors.
Just actors.
Right.
I would like to lead with my take.
Very good.
Okay? And again, and this was what made me think of all this, the idea of creating a long-term strategy. Performers of all stripes need a strategy, a representative body that has long-term possibilities. And part of that is the ability that SAG hasn't had for decades to react, respond, rather, quickly and flexibly to circumstances that are changing so radically.
Rapid, yes.
My take is not only, and I'm, this is much different than how I felt years ago, but the and I forget what these unions are, but I, Equity,
the Stage, yeah, Actors Stage Union, Actors, yeah.
And whatever the federation is that represents all musical artists, recording artists,
Yeah.
Have both come out really endorsing this merger idea. And not only endorsing this merger idea, but saying not only do we hope it merges, but we hope we merge with them next.
Oh.
And this, to me, and some people are going to disagree with me. David might disagree with me. I really am at the point where I think when you are facing a negotiating opponent,
right,
let's say, that is comprised of huge multimedia conglomerates.
Yes.
You need to be able to apply pressure in as many different areas as possible.
True.
You might think, well, Equity doesn't generate much revenue. They don't, you know, why would that be important for actors? Well, first of all, they are actors. And secondly, you don't think that Equity merged in with SAG would be a helpful
negotiating
stick against Disney?
Yeah.
Which makes more money off
live
events than they do off television or film.
That's right. Yeah, and then Disney on Ice, all that sort of thing.
You start to think of all the different places you can apply pressure. Think of it both in terms of media and geography.
Yeah.
Right? So that's my take, is that is that when you have multimedia conglomerate as the nature of your opponent, it requires not only this merger, but further mergers.
So you're
as well.
Suggesting that the solution to
is a union that represents all
everything.
Performing artists,
right? And bring in magicians and variety artists, like the VAG, the Variety Artists Guild.
Now, again, does that mean that I'm advocating this particular merger? I'm not advocating that anyone vote for that. I'm just saying that this is my particular
idea.
Point of view
right.
on this, that this is what we need to be working towards. So whatever I say, understand that it's coming through that particular prism.
Very good.
A big problem to David at this time is that the pension and health operations are completely separate
still,
from the merger.
Yes, and that's the biggest problem.
And, you know, try asking for a straight answer from anyone putting this plan together about what happens if you have three pension credits in one union, three pension credits in another. I don't want to get into the specifics of this, especially for our audience that
right. Doesn't.
That might be they might be spinning on this.
Right.
But the truth is absolutely no one knows. No one does know. No one can know. These are entirely separate entities. The trustees of these entities are comprised of people appointed by the unions
right.
and by the industry that's paying into it.
Right, the producers, guild.
Merging them is virtually impossible, according to David, because the board members have a fiduciary responsibility to protect the funds in the plan. There's two things. You will find people who say merging the plans are not virtually impossible. It is true that they have a fiduciary responsibility. However, my understanding is that the fiduciary responsibility is not to protect the funds. It's to protect the participants
in
the plan. They have a fiduciary responsibility to the participants.
To make sure the funds are there. To make sure
So yes, there is the possibility that these will never merge. It is the, you know, there is that possibility. If the vote goes through for merger, you can be well assured, though, that the trustees of these plans would get together and go, okay, what do we do now?
What do we do?
And one of the big impetus behind that is actually the health portion of it, the health plan.
Right.
Because you do need to understand that the more people you have
participating in a health plan, the bigger the plan can be, which means the better of the terms. You can go out and get a better plan.
A bigger thing, because you're negotiating with millions and millions of dollars as opposed to just a couple million dollars or whatever
Merging health plans will be an impetus on both sides to create a merger between these.
In order to reduce the cost.
And should, if people are smart, lead to a better plan.
Right.
Whereas not merging really will... If you think of where things have been heading, you have to look at the pattern across the board, I think, of where things have been heading and say, okay, if there isn't merger, you know, it's going to continue along this pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
The Screen Actors Guild healthcare plan has been eroding.
Whereas
AFTRA, surprisingly, their health plan has been getting better.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. But that's also because they've...
Slightly better.
But they're also negotiating all the cable deals, right. So they're getting more money in the coffers. So they have a chance to improve only because their war horse for pensions has gotten bigger.
So, you don't know. This is entirely unknown. It should be pointed out, though, that there is no way to create a merger where this would be a known quantity.
Because I can't negotiate that beforehand?
You can't, because the unions do not have any control over that.
Ah, right.
So there is no circumstance under which the only way is you could try to the pension and health on their own could try to merge, but they can't because they have a fiduciary responsibility.
Right.
So to do what's best for the participants. If the participants are now in one union, a very strong case could be made that it would benefit those participants to have a merged.
So then there will be a second.
But you've got to take it on faith, and faith is so hard to come by in this environment.
In this town. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he's absolutely right.
That sucks. So then Ari Gross says.
Well, and this is, but he takes a very different view on it, which is very optimistic that, no, look, the clearer heads will prevail and they will do what is economically best. And he takes the other side of it, which is you are about to see, if SAG doesn't get this merger, you're going to see the SAG health
care thing
really crater.
Crater fast, and fast.
Because it's teetering as it is.
They nearly closed the old folks home and all that sort of thing. So I would think they're
very David also line. Asks... you know, with people planning this merger, the plan is to legally shutter both SAG and AFTRA the day of the merger. So then how are they going to deal with the fact that the contracts not covered by the new union will continue? Because the old contracts that have already been negotiated continue for several years. So who administers those?
Right.
The contract is between you, the individual actor, and the producers.
Right.
The agency that has collectively bargained for you set those terms.
Right.
But the deal is with you.
Yes.
You have every legal recourse still. And when it comes to, again, pension and health aspects, as we've said, the trustees are still in place.
Those are
the same people that continue to independently administer those aspects of the deal will still
continually be in
place.
Right. So any negotiating issue that comes up with contracts in place, you can actually just go get a lawyer. Which would be expensive, of course, but if in terms of conflict resolution.
Now, one of the interesting aspects of this that has bothered several people and that David expressed to me quite eloquently is about, you know, the nature of Global Rule 1.
Oh, yeah.
About doing non-union work will no longer be steadfast under the terms of the merger because of certain broadcasters in AFTRA who are non-union.
Ah.
What is interesting, though, and this just has to be whether or not you think this will work and whether you think this is a good idea, I find that there was a very concerted effort on the part of people creating this proposed constitution for merger, if you read it, to put those people in a box, to isolate them. Right. Yes, they acknowledged that these broadcasters, there were certain shops that were never made union. They never had the ability. CNN was never
a union shop.
A union shop.
Really?
So the broadcasters that worked there, many of them joined the union, but the shop never could
be a union house. Union. Right.
And there are these, many of them are small stations.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are, so there's hundreds of broadcasters that are members of AFTRA but are not in union shops.
Hmm.
So the effort is being made to put them in a box, which is very interesting. And one of the examples is MSNBC is Rachel Maddow, who's a big star, right?
Right. But
it's
non-union.
It's non-union. She is a member of the union, but it's a non-union shop. But here's the idea, and this is what they've put in. You can continue to do, honor your pre-existing contracts.
Right.
You can do your show if it is a non-union shop. However, you can't go and do a union show and go back to your non-union show.
Oh.
Which means, if you're Rachel Maddow, there's no appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Right. Because that's a union.
And get to go back. And what's intriguing about this, does this mean it'll work? No, I don't know. But I do, I like the thinking. As you know, I like the idea of trying to come up with a solution to kind of complex problems.
Right.
Because the idea is, how do you make those shops union?
Right.
And if Rachel Maddow is no longer able to promote her own show,
then
doesn't
that,
it become in the best interest of MSNBC to go union?
Because they need her eyeballs, as it were, the audience that she draws to make that money to then. Oh, yeah.
We're not coming up with any answers here. We're not telling you. We're posing questions that are potential problems.
Potential problems.
And also, you know, hopefully the idea that, look, there might be solutions to this.
There may be cooler heads prevailing.
And again, research this for yourself.
Yes.
And don't be swayed by anger or fear or whatever. I mean,
yes.
Go and find information.
And find the right
information. And vote. And definitely vote.
And, oh, yeah, vote.
David said he's not too excited about the clause in the new Constitution that allows SAG and AFTRA to collect a fee to distribute residuals.
Mm.
Board members have told him that they're not going to do that for the rank and file. And indeed,
right.
Imagine the furor over that. It needs to be pointed out, though, that this already exists.
Oh, it does.
It does. Do you get any of these checks that show, they're small checks, but that show residuals from foreign territories?
Yes, like Canada.
You'll notice that a fee's cut out. Because the SAG has to hire collection agencies in those territories to be able to get that money.
Right.
And so it is cut out.
Already.
And that is the reason. So again, is that a potentially disturbing thing? Yes, it is. Is there a reason to have that allowed? Yes, there is.
Right.
So again, it comes down to, again, what is in short supply, trust and faith. And do you think they really would do the wrong thing by the membership?
Right.
There are people who feel that their power has been usurped. There are people who, yeah, you might not trust that the right thing is going to be done by you. But again, there are reasons for these things if you look for them. Does that make them good ideas? Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
But it is always a good idea to try to find the reasoning behind it. The one thing that I would take most exception with to something that David suggested, and he admitted it was kind of a minor point maybe, is that it's going to be a Delaware corporation. The new union would be a Delaware corporation.
But that's a lot of corporations like that, though.
Yeah, and David's problem was that it makes it easier to get off the hook if the union does something illegal.
Hmm.
And perhaps that's true. I don't know. What I do know from my end is that Delaware, again, when it comes to contract law, is a very good call. If you're going to incorporate, you don't want to incorporate in California. We have one of the worst court backlogs there is. And if you're talking about a union that might need to respond quickly, especially change its constitution quickly to respond to
issues.
The ever-changing nature of media negotiations,
you want
a court system that can respond quickly. Also, by the way, this is what Delaware does.
Right.
This is their expertise.
Thing. Absolutely.
You've got the best contract lawyers working, and it becomes the template, by the way, for how corporate and contract law is done the rest of
it. And not only that, when you're going national, then you have the ability in other states to, by being a Delaware, correct me if I'm wrong, by being a Delaware corporation, you have national enforcement of your contract, whereas if you're a California corporation, some of those aren't recognized in, like, the state of Nevada, for instance.
Yeah.
So I sort of see it, but it is a point.
David is also upset that way the voting is done. Hollywood actors who will contribute 65% of the income of the entire union will no longer have majority votes on the board of directors or in any committee. And he refers to it as taxation without representation.
Hmm.
Now, I would hazard against that argument about taxation without representation, because to say that the 65% deserve more representation because of the money that they generate is to a degree to argue that the 1% of this country that has 90% of the wealth should also get 90%. Now they do have 90%.
Yeah, they do.
But to actually say that their votes should be weighted as individuals, I've got...
That's called super PAC, yeah.
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable with that.
You're right. I mean, Tom Cruise shouldn't get 24 votes. Over.
And that's the other thing, is that so much of this 65% of the revenue, how much of that comes from stars that are not really on the side of other actors anyway?
Anyway, I know. They're their own corporations.
But I would like to point out that the proposal for the merger, it will still allow the largest local will always have the largest representation. The largest local, it's just not guaranteeing Hollywood.
Right.
Because it is actually advocating, again, if you merge with other unions and you start to take in
revenue from
other sources, you never know. I know this sounds funny, but with climate change, who knows where the largest local would
be. Right. Suddenly we're all be in Louisiana shooting.
You know, or Mountain View, California. I don't know. It does allow for the largest local to still have the largest representation. And at the same time, though, it would require at least a 5% vote from other localities.
Right.
No majority block within one local can unilaterally pass something.
Right.
I don't know. I like that as a more democratic ideal moving forward. But again, as I said, I'm looking for
long term
that is long term and that is bringing in other performance.
Merge Equity, Variety Artists, Ice Capades. Do they have their own union? Ice skaters?
And
how about sports figures too then? Where do you draw that line there?
You know, phase one to merger, which is the full name of it. Phase one to merger was passed in 1981. So we're talking 31 years of trying to get a merger. Realize we voted on merger in 98. We voted on it in 2003, and we're voting on it again.
Right. And how different has the condition changed between each time of those?
And it didn't pass by 600 votes. And it failed to get the 60% needed by 600 votes.
Ouch.
In 2003.
Yeah.
We can't allow more contracts to slip away.
Wow, that's true.
If theatrical
and, more non-union.
and now that theatrical is no longer film.
Yeah.
It's all on video or digital. I feel like that ball game is going to that playing field is going to open up if there isn't merger.
Yes.
And if SAG were to lose theatrical or, dear God, commercials.
Tough.
Then it's SAG that is over.
Yeah. I'm still undecided. So
I know. Yeah. I know. So anyway. So again, we encourage people to do what we did: reach out to people who
don't have a
stake in fighting.
Right.
They have a stake in trying to find answers.
Yes.
And so thank you to David and thank you to Ari.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can find almost every show of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com.
Yes, you can
download and stream us. And
RSS.
Subscribe via iTunes.
So easy.
Also, follow us on Twitter.
And I'm at D. Haglin.
And I'm at Phil Larness.
And we're at Facebook.
We already did all that.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't we?
No, Facebook. We didn't. We didn't do Facebook. We did MySpace.
Yeah.
The fact that we're on MySpace is still hilarious.
Okay. Whatever. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Belated spoiler alert.